Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina offers a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We are coming to you this week from Brooklyn, New York. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined, of course, by Jeremy Goldhorn of the National Rifle Association. How are you, Jeremy?
Packing heat, man. All right. China's economy, now the world's second largest, and despite its recent slowdown, still expected at some point to surpass the total size of the U.S. economy, is really something everyone needs to know about. Its fortunes touch lives from Maine to Malawi. And yet, despite how much conversation there is on the Chinese economy, whether in the U.S., where we're now hearing Donald Trump saying China is raping the United States, and many predicting a very hard landing, or even on the ground back in China, where Kaiser and I have spent so much of our lives, it's often hard to get a firm grasp on the actual picture. How threatening is overcapacity or the local debt problem? Are we underestimating China's economic resilience, or should we be preparing for the collapse long predicted in some especially bearish quarters?
So today on Cynica, we're delighted to welcome back, Arthur Kroeber, who in April published an excellent book that I cannot recommend highly enough. It's called China's Economy, What Everyone Needs to Know. Arthur is managing director of Gavcall Dragonomics, an independent global economic research firm, and editor of its journal, China Economic Quarterly. Arthur, welcome back to Cynica.
It is great to be back with you, gentlemen.
Well, great. So Arthur, your approach to China's economy is markedly different, I would say, from some of the other widely cited commentators. I have my own ideas as to what those basic differences might be, but I'd like to hear from you without necessarily naming names.
Michael Pettis.
how you think your approach specifically differs?
Well, I'd say the main difference that I have in general with a lot of people who write on the Chinese economy is I try to have a much more historical perspective on these things. I am not actually a trained economist. I have long had an interest in history and culture, and I kind of stumbled into economics in China as a way of, as a lens through which to understand the ways that society is changing. And as I've gotten more and more deeply into this, I've really had a difficulty with a lot of economic analysis which ignores the kind of larger historical and social context of things. So what I tried to do in this book, which basically covers the entire period of Chinese economic reform since 1979, was to present obviously an understanding of the economic facts, but really to situate them in a historical context. And I think if you take that broader view, you wind up with a somewhat different set of conclusions than people who are looking at it from a more narrowly economic or financial perspective.
And then what strikes me about your book, and what I think is both really useful and very refreshing about it, is how often it really challenges what I think everyone thinks they know about China's economy. In fact, I mean, as Jeremy and I were prepping for the show, I suggested titling it, I think we will, Arthur Kroeber versus the Conventional Wisdom. So I think that's the approach we're going with. Let's throw some of the received wisdom at you and see what you have to say.
So let's start with the very common belief that China is highly centralized, not only in terms of being centrally planned, but also in terms of Beijing's control over the provinces. You challenged that idea, Arthur, and I personally was very surprised to see that a whopping 85% of government spending is at the subnational level.
Yeah, this is one of the, and I learned a little bit more about just how China is decentralized in the process of researching this book. And there were some things that I didn't know, even though I'd lived in China for nearly 20 years. But, you know, I think most people who spend a lot of time in China, and particularly if you spend a significant amount of time outside Beijing, quickly understand that this is a state which is, at the formal level, it is highly centralized. And there is a Communist Party that does attempt to get into every nook and cranny of the country and does exercise, in certain respects, a great deal of control. But informally, it's highly decentralized, and there's enormous amount of flexibility that exists at local levels. And I think this is important for two reasons. So first of all, I think a lot of analogies are drawn between China and other communist states, particularly the Soviet Union. And I think one of the central issues is, from a Western point of view, is this question of how can you maintain a highly centralized communist political system with a dynamic capitalist economy? How can this mixture possibly last? And I think a lot of the sort of pessimistic view, or very pessimistic view, takes the analogy of the Soviet Union to say, well, look, they tried it and didn't work. And I think it's very important to understand that China has always been, even when Mao was running, it was always way more decentralized in terms of economic decision making than the Soviet Union ever was. So I think that's an important element of the equation. I think the other point is that China is this, yeah, it's a weird combination of certain elements of a command economy where the party and the central government do have a lot of influence over things at the top level. And on the other hand, a very, very dynamic bottom-up private economy, which marches to the beat of its own drummer and is really in tension with it, that centralization. So I think it's too simple to say that China is centralized or decentralized. It's both at the same time, and that's what makes it so interesting.
So related to that, despite Xi Jinping's pronouncements at the third plenum of the 18th Party Congress about market forces, are we still in a situation where state-owned enterprises are advancing and the private sector is in retreat? I think Guo Jin Min Tui was the coinage used during the Hu Jintao era. Is that still happening?
Well, again, this is one of these things where once you scrape beneath the slogan, life becomes very complicated. So the basic story of the Chinese economy from 1979 until quite recently was that you had a steady expansion of the role of the private sector. Private sector share of pretty much everything, employment, industrial production, investment, whatever, continued to rise, even though the state retained very tight control over certain aspects of the so-called commanding heights of the economy. And you're right, starting around 2008, 2009, people started talking about Guo Jin Min Tui, which means
The state sector advancing
and the private sector retreating. And the idea was that this tide of private sector expansion was being reversed. That was never really true, because if you look at the data, you see that the private sector share of everything has continued to expand. But two things I think are important. First of all, since 2008, the rate at which the private sector role has expanded has been slowing down. So in other words, we had a very, very rapid advance of this of the private sector in particularly the late 90s to about 2008. It's still advancing, but at a much, much slower pace. And that, I think, is that's an important shift. Second point would be that even though the private sector in aggregate is very, very large, it's highly fragmented. There are few really, really big private firms. And so the concentration of power within the state sector is quite high. And then the final point, I think this is what you were getting at, Jeremy, is that under Xi Jinping, I think we have seen a real shift in the top-level rhetoric and the top-level policy direction, much more explicitly in favor of a bigger state role in the economy. And I would say that this is a clear dividing line between Xi Jinping and all of the previous leaders of China within the reform era, who to one degree or another were explicitly tolerant of an expanded private sector role. That seems not so much to be the case now.
One of the things that I really enjoyed about the book was that you really do march through the whole history of the reform period and how it was that, that China achieved the economic prowess that it now enjoys, although it is slacking. And you know, conventional wisdom has all sorts of ideas about how this actually happened. And one of the things you often hear is that it was, you know, built essentially through a policy of mercantilism, through outright theft of intellectual property and all that sort of stuff. How much truth is there to that conventional, that received wisdom.
And if those aren't the factors, you know, what would you say are the main reasons for China's double-digit growth?
Yeah. Well, yeah, so that obviously that's one of the big themes that I deal with. And I think the fact is that, you know, there is some truth to that, those assertions. But I think where, if you will, the conventional wisdom gets it wrong is that there's something weird or unusual about China's reliance on mercantilism. And then I think the other thing that the conventional wisdom misses is just the other sort of special sets of factors that are involved. So my basic thesis is that a lot of what China did was basically just copied from a well-established development playbook, which actually started in the United States of America. One of the things that you don't learn typically as a student in an American elementary or high school is that in the early 20th century, the United States had a very strong state-led development ethos. It was called the American system. It was developed by people like Alexander Hamilton and Henry Clay. It involved a lot of state activity, much of which involved things like seizure of land from its native owners and so forth. It also involved extraordinarily high tariffs and intellectual property theft. The United States was one of the most notorious pirates of intellectual property from Europe through much of the 19th century. And we kept, really until World War II, we kept one of the highest tariff rates in the world, protecting our domestic industries so that we could build up giant export positions. And there was a guy called Friedrich List, who was a German economist in the mid-19th century, who came and looked at this and said, this is a pretty good idea. Let's take this back to Germany. And essentially Bismarck's whole program for developing Germany was copied from the American system. Japan, when it opened up in the late 1860s, sent a delegation of people around the world to see what's the best way to industrialize really, really quickly. They went to Germany and they said, this looks like it's working really well. Let's try that. And so the Japanese development model in the late 19th, early 20th centuries was copied from the List program. And then after World War II, they extended it and Japan, Taiwan and Korea picked it up. And the basic idea is that you basically have a financial system that is either owned by the state or directed by the state that can capture the savings from an efficient agricultural sector. It's important to have an efficient agricultural sector as a starting point. And then the state-directed financial institutions plow this into infrastructure, education, these basic enabling tools, and they promote export-oriented manufacturing. And the reality is that you cannot find a single example of a country that's gone from being poor to being one of the rich countries in the world that has not followed this playbook. It's the only one that we know works. So when the Chinese came along in the early 1980s, they looked around and said, okay, what works? And what works was this. Return land to the tiller, because when you have a lot of labor, you get the most productivity out of land if it's individually owned rather than in big plantations. Generate a big agricultural surplus. Capture that surplus in your state-owned financial system. Have the state-owned financial system invest in heavy industry, infrastructure, education, and so forth, and then do everything you can to promote export-oriented manufacturing. It's a very old recipe. A lot of countries have used it. It's extraordinarily successful, and the only unusual thing about China is that they're, A, the most recent, and B, the biggest country to employ this recipe, which is why it's had such a huge impact. But it's really nothing new.
What about the tariff regime in China? My understanding of it is that it was actually, compared to the others who followed that same recipe, that protectionism was relatively light in China.
Well, there's some ways in which that's true. And I think there are two, if you look at the, you know, so the way the model that I've described is sometimes called in the development literature, it's called the East Asian Developmental State. And this was a term that was coined in the 80s to describe basically what post-war Japan, Korea, and Taiwan did and why they grew so fast, right? And my argument is essentially that China takes a lot of the East Asian developmental state model, but there are two big, big differences. One is foreign direct investment. So Japan, Korea, and Taiwan post-war, they had almost no foreign companies operating domestically. They had very high walls, and it was domestic companies that led the charge. China, famously in the 1980s, started out by opening the door to foreign investors into places like Shenzhen and so forth, and kick-starting their export manufacturing industries that way. Very, very unusual. So at the peak in the 90s, China's about 15% of China's fixed investment each year came from foreign direct investment, which is extraordinarily high. Mm. The other big difference, obviously, was that China was a post-communist country, so it had a huge state-owned enterprise sector, which Japan, Korea, and Taiwan did not.
Japan instead had the Keiretsu system.
Japan had the Keiretsu system. Korea actually did have some state-owned enterprises, and Taiwan had a lot in the early days, but very quickly transitioned out of that.
Arthur, sorry, could I interrupt? Could you explain the Keiretsu system?
And Chaebols while you're at it.
So I tell you what, why don't we come back to that in a second and just let me complete this thought, because I think that is important. The key point that I wanted to make here simply is that, just to address, Kaiser, your question about the openness, right, is that, yeah, China was forced in a certain way to be much more open than most other developing countries. And the question is why? Why were they so open to foreign direct investment, and why did they have this much more liberal trade regime? I think the central answer to that has to do with geopolitics. So when Korea, Japan, and Taiwan were developing in the 50s and 60s, they were part of the U.S. security network in the Pacific.
Under the nuclear umbrella.
They were under the umbrella, and there was basically a deal. And the deal was the U.S. said, okay, you will be our bulwarks against communism in the Pacific, and you will let us station zillions of troops.
And there. We erect huge protectionist barriers.
And you can have total access to our markets, and you can just do whatever you need to do to get rich. And that was a good deal for those countries. When China came along, they couldn't get that deal because, guess what, they were a communist country. And even if they were a tactical ally against the Soviet Union, there was still that wasn't going to work. So they had to bring something else to the table. That something else was an extraordinary level of market access. So that is an unusual and unique feature of the Chinese economy. So on the question of the Keiretsu and the Chaebol, this sort of gets into a whole other sort of set of issues, which is the state-owned enterprises and the role that they play in the Chinese economy. And that's a very contentious issue, I think, increasingly so, as these enterprises invest more and more internationally. And I think you can see the state-owned enterprise system in China as kind of like the counterpart of the Keiretsu system in Japan and the Chaebol system in Korea. So the Keiretsu are basically a set of interlocking enterprises that have cross-shareholdings in one another, joined at the hip or joined, you know, as a node with a bank. So in the Japanese system, you have a bank at the center. It's called the main bank. And then there are all of these other enterprises in all kinds of industries that have cross-shareholdings with the banks.
Some examples of these are?
So this would be like Mitsubishi, sure, or, you know, even companies like Toyota and so forth. But the Mitsubishi, Sumitomo, some of the big trading houses typically that were also involved in a whole swath of industries. And the idea is that the companies get a long-term, you know, shareholder and financier, and so you don't have to be prisoner of quarterly sort of expectations. So you get more stable long-term growth is the idea. The Koreans had a similar system called Chaebol, which are big, giant conglomerates.
Generally family.
And generally family-owned, which is true of a lot of the Japanese companies. But I think the family influence in Japan, partly because of the aftermath of World War II, was deliberately reduced. Whereas in Korea, basically, they were all kind of family-owned. And the big difference between them and the Keiretsu is that the Korean government did not permit them to have banks as part of the equation. So you could be a conglomerate, you could be invested in 70 different industries, but you couldn't have a bank. And the reason for that was that the Korean government under Park Chung-hee in the 60s and 70s wanted to have ultimate control over these guys, and they felt that the government controlled the finance and then the companies controlled the production, that would work. So you have these systems which create an ability for bureaucracies, industrial enterprises, and finance institutions to work together for development goals. And, you know, basically in China, the state-owned enterprise system forms the is the same performs the same function.
So the upshot is that there is quite a bit of truth to it, that they did follow that same mercantilist policy, that there was a lot of IP theft. But this isn't unusual.
Everyone does it. If you want to get rich, you have to do it. That's the point. So let's let's get off our high horse and just accept that as a reality of how the world works.
People have often asked me, just sort of in layman's terms, what caused urban China to become as wealthy as it did quite suddenly? Why was suddenly everybody? And I've always said, well, it was the distribution of Danway housing. How much of a factor was this?
I think that was a huge factor in wealth creation, and it's a huge factor in one of the biggest social problems in China, which is just the huge inequality that you have there. So, yeah, and I think this is really a key thing to understand, not only sort of the dynamics of wealth, but also the dynamics of the Chinese housing market, which everyone, you know, needs to pay attention to because of its global impact.
And that's my next question. But first, I want to ask, is there a rural counterpart then to housing distribution? And is this really sort of the root of rural and urban inequality?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So the point here is that through the 90s, most urban housing was not on a market system. Most people got their apartment through their state-owned work unit. And they paid rent of $1 a month or some, minimal fee for that. And then one of the great achievements of the Zhu Rongji premiership in the late 90s and early 2000s was essentially to privatize this market. And it was a step that was kind of similar to what Margaret Thatcher did in the 1980s with council housing in the UK, except on a gigantic scale. So over the space of 5 or 6 years, a vast majority of the state-owned enterprise housing in urban China was sold to its occupants at well below any reasonable expectation of its market price. So one way to think of this is that it was a huge wealth transfer from the state to the household sector. So let's say you had an apartment and the state said, well, you can buy this for $100 and probably we'll lend you the money so that you can buy it.
Right. No one I know was unable to actually purchase when offered.
Yeah, that's right. So there were a lot of schemes involved to enable people actually to come up with this money. So you were able to buy this for $100. And then 5 years later, when the lockup period ended, you could often sell it on the market for 5 or 10 or 15 times that. Or even if the house was demolished as part of redevelopment, you would... In most cities, you would get some kind of compensation for that, which was much, much higher than what you paid for it. So we did a calculation, my colleagues and I at Dragonomics did a calculation that the value of that capital transfer of state-owned housing from the state to the household sector was equivalent to about one-third of 2003 GDP. And 2003 was kind of when the lockups started ending. So just think of, if you imagine one-third of GDP suddenly being thrown into the hands of the private sector through real estate, this is what set off the huge real estate boom. So if you were sitting in urban China and you were able to get in on that deal, or even if you were able to buy a house in the market at a very early stage there, you did great. But in the countryside, you're still not allowed to own your own house. The state still owns all land. They've been very resistant to doing that same deal for people in the countryside. So urban dwellers got this huge gift of wealth from the state, and rural dwellers didn't. And that's why you have such great wealth in the cities and how it emerged so quickly. And that's why you have this gigantic gap between the cities and the countryside.
And that data also would explain to me why I feel as I went to live in a hutong in the middle of Dongcheng for a few years around that time. And I sometimes feel as it was like Rip Van Winkle when I went into that hutong. Beijing was still poor, and when I came outside, everybody was driving around in fancy cars and wearing Nike sneakers.
Right, I remember that turning point for me. I'll never live it down. Why?
Yeah.
So, about how you went from being perceived as rich to being perceived as poor in the matter of, you know, just a few years.
I think I'm like you guys in that I, as a Beijing resident, utterly failed to take advantage of this great real estate boom and never bought any property there, much to my undying regret. But I have less excuse because theoretically I was like, you know,
you're supposed to be watching this shit, Arthur.
I was supposed to be watching the economy, and I didn't get it while it was going on.
So let's talk about housing. The conventional wisdom once again says that there's a housing bubble, that between this and, well, I mean, a plethora of other problems, but let's talk about the real estate market, but also about the local debt problem, and more generally this notion that a collapse is imminent, or at least a hard landing, that these are inevitable. I do want to talk about, you know, this scenario that you're going to, I want to unpack this later on, the likely scenario that you're now forecasting. But first, let's talk about this sort of collapsist vision.
So let's start with the housing market, because I think that's, a lot of people pay attention to that, and there's a lot of confusion. And I go back to the central point that I made a minute ago, which is that it's really crucial to understand that the whole housing boom in China started with this massive urban housing privatization. And the point is that you started out with a situation where urban property was phenomenally undervalued in the early 2000s. There had been no market for 50 years in urban land. And so the so-called land values were nothing close to what a true market value was. So you had a period of several years in the early 2000s up until probably about 2008, 9, or 10, where you had very rapid escalation in housing prices. And most of that was just land and property prices catching up to the true market value. So you had a lot of people, you know, then saying, oh, it's a housing bubble. Oh, it's going to collapse. And it never really happened. And I think, you know, people misunderstood where all of this price appreciation was coming from. And I think that's still broadly the case if you're in Beijing or Shanghai or Shenzhen or a lot of the second tier, you know, wealthy cities on the coast. You've had some excess building, but these are very wealthy cities. People want to live in them. There's rapidly, increasing immigration and demand. So yeah, housing prices are pretty high, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're in a bubble, right? I think the real problems started after 2009, when you had a gigantic stimulus in response to the global financial crisis, and a lot of that stimulus went into housing investment, and a lot of that went into just willy-nilly building of housing, and a lot of smaller cities where it made no sense. So pretty much if you go to any city in China, no matter what size, you will find some vast housing developments on the outskirts of town, which sort of imply that the city thinks it's going to become the next Shanghai. And guess what? There's only one Shanghai in China, and those like other 500 cities that think they're going to be Shanghai are not ever going to be Shanghai. So you did have a lot of overbuilding, and you do now have a situation where there is, not in every city, but in a bunch of particularly the smaller cities, you know, excess inventory that will probably never be fully absorbed. So it's a problem, but I think it's a more sort of fragmented problem than often people see as the case. The other thing I think that's really important to understand, particularly for U.S. Listeners, is that China has a lot of problems in the housing market, but the problems it has are not the problems of the U.S. housing market in the 2000s.
Part of that is that it's not nearly as leveraged.
Right. That's basically what it is. In the U.S., you had people buying houses for 5% down or 0% down on, you know, completely, you know, unrealistic valuations. In China, still on the average down payment is over 40%. The legal minimum in most places is 20. You don't see much leverage in household balance sheets. So there are definitely some issues in the Chinese housing market. And I think the housing construction has peaked forever and will go down from here. But the particular kinds of problems we had in the U.S. are not the kinds of problems that we see in China.
Hmm. A couple of years ago, your colleague, Tom Miller, was on our show. And he had written a book about urbanization. And a quote that I remember from it really well was, yes, there are a lot of white elephants, but the Chinese metabolism is high enough to digest a few white elephants and the boondoggles. Do you sort of hold to that, or is
yeah?
This,
and I think well, are we so I think indigestion. I agree with that, but there's also a risk that we have to flag. Okay, so the point about this is, for a long time, over 30 years, China was growing at 10% a year. Okay, now what does that mean? What that means is the economy doubles in size every 7 years. And so, what does that mean? Well, you look at, if you at a given point in time, you look around, and you think, okay, everything that I see here, this is the Chinese economy as I know it. Now I imagine that whole thing, a second one of that, which does not yet exist, popping up right next to it, and that's going to happen in the next 7 years. Everything that I see now is going to be replicated within 7 years. And when you have that kind of growth pattern, yes, you can absorb any number of white elephants. The problem that I see now is that logic is beginning to unravel because it's not... you don't have growth of 10% anymore. You know, I think a sustainable growth rate, if they get all of the policy things right, is more in the neighborhood of, you know, 5 or 5.5% over the next 10 to 15 years. That means that you are more than doubling the amount of time it takes to double the size of the economy. And then if you've been building and building and building on the assumption that you're going to grow by 10% forever, and then suddenly you're not, you're growing by 5%, then a lot of people are left holding a lot of bags. And that I think we are now at a point where we have to start, you know, worrying about the consequences of that downshift in growth.
So can we talk a little bit about local debt? I know it's related. This is another one of the things that we hear a lot of commentary about, that China is going to collapse under the weight of local debt. What is your take on this?
Well, so I think the maybe a little bit of historical background and my views on this is in order here. So for years and years, people have been talking about debt problems in China since I came to China in 1991, right? There's always been a story, China's going to collapse tomorrow because of either the debt is too big or because too many of the debts are non-performing, right? And this idea has been wrong for a very, very long time. And I built a large part of my career by pointing out that this was wrong. So we really are at the point now, though, where the debt level is a significant concern, and we're probably about 3 or 4 years away from a day of reckoning on the debt problems if we don't see some significant changes. I think the point I would make on the local government debt is, yes, it's an issue. Yes, the debt needs to be restructured, but even when you add in the local government liabilities, the total government debt in China is somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% of GDP, or maybe a little bit higher. That's combined central and local government debts. And that's not a very high number. The OECD average is about 100%. And there are plenty of other developing countries like India and Brazil that have significantly higher levels. So I don't see government debt as really being the central problem. The central problem is state-owned enterprise debt. Corporate debt in China is now about 160% of GDP. That is way, way north of the average. So if you look at debt levels in state enterprises and private enterprises, private companies in China have debt levels that are about the same relative to their balance sheets as companies in Germany, and it's not changing that much. So private companies seem to be managing their finances pretty well. State-owned enterprises in China, on average, have debt that's the same as companies in Portugal or Greece, and that is where the real debt problem in China lies, and it's getting worse, and it's a serious problem.
And so what happens if there's a day of reckoning? Those companies just don't have enough money to keep their operations going and pay their salaries.
Like, think of SOEs essentially as a social program? In some ways.
And we can. I think it would be nice if we didn't have to. That was certainly back in the 1990s when we had a big, SOE crisis. And, there was 50% of GDP almost was tied up in non-performing loans to state-owned enterprises. In that era, it was very, very clear that a lot of the lending to state-owned enterprises was really just social transfers. They poured money into the SOEs. The SOEs pretended to employ people and, paid them a small amount of money and housed them and so forth. It was really a social welfare transfer. And a lot of the SOE reforms of the late 90s were designed to stop the SOEs from being a social welfare program and turn them into real companies, right? So it would be a little bit dispiriting if after 20 years we were just back in the same place that we were back in the late 90s. So I think it's important to recognize that, yes, there is kind of a social welfare component to state-owned enterprises, and that's something that they, you know, China really needs to get rid of, and they need to focus these companies on doing what companies should be doing, which is, you know, generating productive investments. So, yeah, I think the issue with the SOEs, I mean, to your question, Jeremy, what happens? It's not necessarily clear that anything happens because, of course, you have state-owned banks lending to state-owned enterprises, and everyone has some kind of an amorphous guarantee from the government at some level. So as long as everyone in the system is willing to keep pretending, this kind of system can go on for quite a long time. And the problem with that is, I think, essentially the problem, the trap that Japan fell into in the 1990s, which is that you had a bunch of companies that couldn't repay their debts, banks which were technically insolvent because if they actually called in their loans, they wouldn't be able to recover them.
You'll have a lot more to say about the comparisons to Japan in the 90s, and let's get to that in just a bit, because I do want to say that you have a whole sort of scenario, and let's save that for the end of our conversation today. Let's talk a little bit about corruption and economic growth. Conventional wisdom, again, suggests that a corrupt society is going to suffer from flagging economic growth. So why has China been able to grow despite corruption? Why is it that, you know, when you've got a highway project in India, one in Russia, and, you know, in India, everyone takes their cut and the highway never gets built. In Russia, everyone, you know, takes their cut and the highway doesn't get built. And, you know, the highway gets built in China. It might not have the right ratio of rebar or concrete.
Right. Yeah, but you do wind up with stuff at the end.
Right.
Yeah, this is actually one of the great mysteries, I think. It's not just conventional wisdom. There's a lot of very sound economic research that shows the higher your corruption, the lower your growth rate over time. And China is kind of an outlier. Why is this? It's a tough question to answer. The answer that I came up with, which owes a lot to some great work that's been done by a guy called Andrew Wiedemann at Georgia Tech, who has written a whole book about this topic.
Yeah, he's the world's corruption expert.
Yeah, his book is terrific, and it really, I think, is quite helpful in understanding how it works in China. I think basically the story is that, first of all, corruption was a tool that was used in the 80s to get a communist bureaucracy on board with the idea of capitalist economic growth. I mean, basically, the problem that Deng Xiaoping faced in the 80s was he inherited this bureaucracy of people who'd been brought up for their ideological correctness, and he wanted them to focus on economic growth. And so basically, the deal that was offered to government officials was, your job is to spur economic growth. We understand that, as in this process of economic growth, you know, a little money may go missing here and there, and we're not going to inquire too deeply into where that money goes, as long as you just like keep it, you know, at a reasonable level. So he was essentially giving people skin in the game. And as long as the general direction of government policy was to more openness, more liberalization, sort of more market forces, a lot of the corruption was essentially a side effect of these reform processes, which were generally productive, right? I think the problem that we now face is that in recent years, the corruption has become less a side effect of liberalizing economic reforms and more just downright stealing. And a lot of it is now construction related, people just skimming off from construction contracts. And, you know, if you're building a lot of stuff that is economically productive in the long run, that's fine. But now China's built so much infrastructure that the returns, the economic returns on each new infrastructure project are a lot lower than they were 5 or 10 years ago. So the stealing becomes a much bigger problem because you're not getting paid off for that stealing and economic growth later.
Yeah, it's always going to be measured against the marginal.
Do you think there's also something in it that there is very little petty corruption in China if you compare it with a lot of African countries or India? I mean, you don't bribe traffic cops in China, whereas like my home country of South Africa, traffic cops will stop you and basically indicate that you can pay them off.
No, I think that's a huge, huge difference, that the sort of like the basic level of social order that is guaranteed by the Communist Party in China in terms of that kind of stuff is extremely high. And, you know, I think we all of us have a lot of problems with the Communist Party and the way that it runs things. But I think you have to concede that one of the things that they do pretty well is maintain that kind of basic level of order so that, no, you don't have to bribe someone, you know, at a street corner or to get your phone installed or any of this kind of stuff. And if you go through much of the rest of the developing world, even the so-called success stories like India, that level of petty corruption is incredibly high. And China really does not have that.
And now we're talking about this sort of inverse correlation. A lot of people are pointing out, saying that Xi's aggressive efforts to stamp out corruption are, in fact, a burden on growth, that there's disincentive for people to actually do things. Do you see any truth to that?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, we just get anecdotal stories all the time, you know, from companies that we talk to about how it's impossible to get any approvals done. No local official wants to, you know, sign off on any kind of new project or do anything innovative, you know, because they're afraid of the consequences. And, you know, you look at the rate of private investment has been slowing in China for the last 6 years in a row. And there are a lot of factors involved in that. But clearly one of them, based on surveys of private business people and so forth, is just this climate of fear. Now, so the question is, okay, is this in the long run, is this a good thing or a bad thing? So I think the impetus behind the anti-corruption campaign is absolutely right. I think, so one of my basic sort of theses about the Chinese economy is that we are exiting a very long period of what I call capital mobilization, where basically the job was just to build a lot of infrastructure, build a lot of heavy industry, put in the foundations of modern economy. And when you're doing that, you know, as my colleague Tom said, you can absorb a lot of white elephants. You can tolerate a lot of corruption because the payoff, the long run payoff and all the stuff that you're building is very high. But we're no longer in that phase. We're now in a phase where growth basically just has to come from productivity. You've built most of the stuff that you need. You're not going to get a higher return from infrastructure. You need to squeeze as much return out of your built environment as you can. And in that kind of environment, you can't absorb all the white elephants. You can't tolerate this level of corruption. You have to move to a more orderly, law-abiding kind of a place. So I think the anti-corruption campaign, to the extent that it's an effort to say, look, we just have to change the rules of the game because the old game, we can't play the old game anymore. That's fine. And I think it's good to have a crackdown in corruption. And as you guys know from having lived there, I mean, the corruption in, you know, the last 4 years had gotten to epic, gargantuan scale and was really, I think, corrosive of the whole social contract. So the price you pay for that is, okay, you're scaring some people into not making so many investments now. You know, maybe that's just a price you have to pay, a little bit slower economic growth, no problem. I think the real concern I have about that is, after this anti-corruption campaign is over, what do we have? Do we have a system in place that has a lower tolerance of corruption, or do we just have people living in fear of the knock on their door?
And that's a very, very good question.
Yeah. And I, you know, it seems like we don't really have a system. We just have fear. And that's, you can't run a successful economy, you know, indefinitely in a climate.
So far, that seems very much to be the case. Let's talk about consumption. Household spending accounts for a very low percentage of China's GDP, as I think many people, many of our listeners certainly know, very, very high savings rate in China. And that, of course, leads to, again, very high levels of investment. And we all hear about Beijing's efforts to rebalance. How's that actually going?
Well, so here I think I really have to slay one of the big conventional wisdom things here, which is that there's been this narrative for years that there was something wrong with China's economy because it invested too much and it consumed too little and it was dangerously imbalanced. And I really just think that that way of looking at things was flat out wrong. If you look at every successful industrialization story, including the United States in the late 19th, early 20th century, these were all cases of unbalanced growth, where you had a lot of investment, consumption was suppressed, and you had, during the intensive period of industrialization, the consumption rate fell. Because why? Because you were doing all of, you were installing the capital of a modern economy. That was the story in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, even in the United States, as far as we can tell, in, you know, pre-Depression. Countries get rich through a period of capital-intensive, unbalanced growth. So China was a little bit more extreme than most other countries that have done that, but it was just basically doing the same thing. So that's point one. Now, point two is, yes, we're now sort of at the end of that capital-intensive phase, and you do need to rely more on consumption spending. But again, I think there's some misapprehensions about how you do this. A lot of people say, well, the government needs to have consumption-friendly policies. And that, I think, is not really the key thing. What you need to have is household income-friendly policies. You need to have policies that give a bigger share of the income pie to households, who will then spend it, than to companies. And, you know, part of this relates to social welfare policies, having
and
a better social...
fiscal and tax reforms, right?
Fiscal and tax reform is a big part of it. Change the incentives of local governments so that they promote service industries, which tend to be much more labor-intensive.
This new move to VAT, what do you make of this? I mean, just in the last couple of days, we've been reading about this.
Okay, well, you're venturing into very technical waters, and I don't know how many of our listeners really want to know about the ins and outs of, like, VAT reform, but... The simple version of this is that if you look at the tax structure of the Chinese government, almost all of tax revenues come from taxes on corporations, and a very large proportion of it comes from value-added tax, which in China is really a production tax. In a lot of European countries, they have a more modern version of VAT, which is more of a tax on consumption. But in China, it's collected from producers, and it really biases governments to promoting, you know, physical production of stuff. And so what they're trying to do is reform the VAT system so that it becomes more of a real consumption tax. They're trying to bring services, which were previously not in the VAT net, trying to bring them into it. And again, the idea is to incentivize governments to promote consumer-oriented businesses and service-oriented businesses, because this is where their tax revenue is going to come from. And if that's successful, that's a good piece of the puzzle. Changing incentives of you know, government officials, who are a big part of the economic development story, I think is very important of how you important part of the way of how you rebalance.
I think you successfully avoided the weeds there. That was good.
Yeah, it's the best I can do.
It's the best you can do.
Another reform we hear a lot about is a reform to the hukou system, or the residence permit system, which basically ties a person's social benefits to often the place where they were born or where they grew up. And from a social perspective, it does create tougher conditions for migrant workers.
Yep.
It separates families, creates left behind children. And it seems inefficient, as it prevents labor from freely moving about to more productive locations. Why doesn't China allow freer movement of labor? And, you know, why, despite all the talk over decades now, hasn't it actually been able to abolish this system?
Yeah, well, I think it's actually not fair to say that this is an impediment to free movement of labor. Because, in fact, labor mobility in China has been extraordinarily high. So what the Chinese system has done is it's enabled free movement of labor and prevented movement of dependents. And the basic idea was that you wanted to have workers in the factories on the coast, but you didn't want them bringing all their dependents and creating slum cities, as in many parts of developing Asia, or just putting a huge burden on the healthcare and education systems in these
all
cities.
All social services, right?
Yeah, and so it was a... you're totally right, Jeremy. It created huge social problems and a lot of family separation and anxiety. And I think from a human perspective, it's a very problematic policy. From an economic rationality perspective, I think you have to say it's been pretty successful. But I think it's definitely it's one of these processes that worked for a while and is clearly past its sell-by date. So there is a goal now to take... So about a third of the urban population in China... are people who do not have urban hukou. And they basically don't act like urban residents, and they don't consume like urban residents, and they don't have access to the full, you know, wealth of urban life. And it's an economic problem, and it's a human problem on a vast scale. So there is a reform to where the aim is to take of those 260 million people or so who don't have urban hukou to give them urban hukou or hukou-like rights. About, I think, 100 million is the target by 2020. If they can pull that off, that would be, I think, a huge benefit for the families, and it would be a huge step towards a more balanced economy, because if you can bring your family and participate in the full social service environment of cities, you begin to spend money like an urbanite, and that creates demand for, you know, more consumer products and services, and that's what China needs now. So I hope they can pull it off. It's a huge task, and I think what they realized after setting this target is that the fiscal burden on local governments to providing the services, they haven't figured out a way to pay for it. It's a real, real problem.
Arthur, last November, China changed its infamous one-child policy, allowing parents to have two children. Conventional wisdom says that China has a ticking demographic time bomb on its hands. What does China's aging population mean for future growth, and what are the implications for the economic model?
Well, I think this may be one instance where conventional wisdom just is not dire enough, because it is a demographic time bomb, and it's really, really serious. So first on the one-child policy, okay, mythology there is that the one-child policy is what caused China to have the low birth rate and as a result this ticking time bomb. Actually, most of the decline in the Chinese birth rate occurred in the 1970s before the one-child policy came into effect, and it was a combination of natural factors and other policies at the time. The one-child policy was really a horrendous case of shutting the barn door after the horse had fled. It imposed a lot of hardships on people because it was enforced in a draconian way, and it was really very intrusive. And it basically served no purpose because China's birth rate was already down. And you can look at other countries like Thailand or Korea, who's had similar declines in the birth rate over the last 25 years or 30 years with no similar family planning policies. So I personally think the one-child policy was one of the worst policy decisions that has been made in China in the last 35 years.
I'm sure Mei Fang would agree with you.
But if you look ahead, regardless of that, so here's the simple factoid. So today, China has about 6 people of working age for every person of retirement age. And that's the same ratio that Japan had in 1980 when it was kind of riding high. In 25 years, China will have 2 people of working age for every person of retirement age. That's the same as Japan today. So in a 25-year span, China is going to go through the same demographic transition that it's taken 35 years for Japan to go through. And I think, you know, that's one of the demographic shift is one of the big problems that Japan has had to face. And it's coming to China. It's coming really soon, and it's coming really fast.
Japan comes up a lot in conversations that we have with you. I mean, you did a turn on our show some time ago, and you talked about where China was relative to Japan. And I think that we were talking about the 1960s in some of your times. Now, though, another Japanese decade comes to mind when you talk about Japan, and that's, of course, the 90s, the so-called lost decade. You recently wrote a paper in which you laid out different scenarios for possible futures of the Chinese economy, and the one that you place sort of your highest odds on is that Japan in the 90s scenario. Can you unpack that a bit for us?
Yeah, I will preface it with a caveat, which is that these kinds of historical comparisons are, I think, useful thought exercises, but they're not really, you know, forecasts. And obviously, there are huge differences between China and Japan. So I don't want to push this too hard. But I think the parallels are really interesting and worth thinking about. So China, in sort of developmental terms and income terms, is about the same as Japan was in the early 1970s. It is about the same level of per capita income and is sort of at the same point on the development curve that Japan was then. Demographically, as I've just said, it's more like Japan in the early 80s. And in terms of its financial position, though, it's a lot more like Japan in 1990. You have huge accumulation of corporate debt. A lot of this is clearly not going to be able to be paid back. There's a kind of an alliance between the state, a preferred group of enterprises, which in China is the SOEs, in Japan it was the Keiretsu, and you have financial institutions that are deeply bound up in these relationships. And there's a huge balance sheet problem. There's a huge problem of debt that can't be repaid, and a huge interest among all of these parties not to face up to it. So if you look at Japan in the 1990s, their problem was that they had a huge property bubble, asset bubble in the late 80s. Asset prices collapsed. Land prices and stock prices went down by about 75% in a few years. This savaged corporate balance sheets. They couldn't repay their loans. The banks were technically insolvent. And, you know, basically because the Japanese government was unwilling to allow this, the resolution of these debt issues to be done rapidly, they extended the problem. They offset the losses with a huge increase in government borrowing to finance infrastructure that had no economic value. And you wound up with a country that had very high debt levels, very low growth levels, and basically no escape. And I could see a similar thing happening in China. You have huge debt buildup in the state-owned enterprises. The government is unwilling to slow down that debt accumulation because basically they have this target of 6.5% growth. We've got to keep going at getting that. And if that means we just have to pile more and more debt into the state enterprises so they can invest in projects that don't generate much of a return, so be it. And, you know, I see the same kind of institutional resistances to just saying, look, we've got to shake things up. We've got to reform. We've got to reduce the role of the state-owned enterprise sector, and we've got to let more market forces and private enterprise rule. So I think, you know, China still has a few years worth of wiggle room. They can still get out of this. And there's an enormous amount of dynamism in the private sector and the SME sector in China, which is really extraordinary. But the clock is ticking, and I think it's basically a matter of 3 or 4 years to get things right, or China will face the prospect of a financial crisis. And I think what will happen in China is that they won't let the financial crisis happen. You won't have sort of a Southeast Asia 1997 type of problem. They'll see it coming, and they'll forestall it by just a huge increase in government spending, government debt, government bailouts, hidden bailouts of debt-ridden institutions, and you'll wind up in a very similar situation to Japan. High debt, low growth, and no escape.
Well, the book is called China's Economy, What Everyone Needs to Know by Arthur R. Kroeber. And I like I said, I couldn't recommend it more highly. It's $10 on Kindle. You pick it up. It's a terrific read, and it's incredibly accessible. So I want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. I want to remind our listeners to check out the Sup China app and subscribe to the newsletter. Sup China offers a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. So download the app and check out supchina.com to subscribe to the newsletter. You can follow Sup China at Sup China News and check them out on Facebook at facebook.com/supchinanews. So let's move on to recommendations. And as usual, we will begin with Jeremy. What do you have for us this week, man?
I'm going to recommend a very slim volume by James Millward, who I think was once your teacher.
He was, and a partner in crime. We used to jam together and stuff. Great
He's
guy.
George musician, probably one of the world's leading experts on Central Asian
and, stringed instruments.
Stringed instruments.
Yes, absolutely.
So the book is called The Silk Road, A Very Short Introduction, published by Oxford. And it's a very elegant little introduction to a fascinating part of the world.
This may be the third Jim Millward book that's been recommended on this show. I think the Eurasian Crossroads has been recommended.
The
Brief History of Xinjiang one has been, yeah. Yeah, great. Beyond the Past, which is a little more scholarly. But yeah, Jim Millward, absolutely terrific guy. Arthur, why don't you go next? What do you have for us this week?
Well, I'm going to recommend something that kind of combines my own interests with economics, but also economic history, but also literature. So it is a great trilogy that's about the Opium War, and it's by an author who lives in Brooklyn, actually, half the year, Amitav Ghosh. He's originally from India. It's called the Ibis Trilogy after the name of the boat that sails between India and China in the Opium War, opium trade years. The first book, which came out a number of years ago, is called Sea of Poppies, and it sort of chronicles life in India in the opium-producing areas. The second book is called River of Smoke, which I think is actually the best book of the series. It's about an Indian opium trader in Guangzhou on the eve of the Opium War. and it's just a terrific chronicle of just how the opium trade really worked and what the human engagements of that were. But it's also just a wonderful, wonderful human story with many, many layers in it, which I won't reveal because they're just too wonderful. And then the final one is called Flood of Fire, which kind of wraps up the story and sort of brings us to the grisly denouement of the Opium Wars and how the whole thing came crashing down. But what I love about this is that it's a great tale. He's got great stories in there, great characters. But he also really brings to life the whole sort of economic ecosphere of Asia in the 19th century and reveals to us how complicated it was and how these networks of trade and just the movement of people were so much more vibrant than we tend to think. We tend to think that globalization is something that happened, you know, 20 years ago. And I think one of the themes of all of Ghosh's work is that, no, globalization is something that's been going on basically since the beginning of time, and nowhere more so than in Asia, which was the locus of these just incredibly complex and rich trade networks. So if you're interested in history, if you're interested in Asia, if you're interested in economics, if you're interested in literature and humanity, that's I would recommend that trilogy.
Well, I'm interested in all those things except for humanity. So. Yeah. Yeah, great. Wow, excellent recommendation. I mean, that's what I'm going to rush out and read. That sounds great. I am going to. I've been recently packing my books as I get ready to leave Beijing, and so I keep stopping, to my wife's chagrin, to flip through some old favorites, and you know, I end up sort of sitting on boxes and reading for a little while. So based on that, I'm going to give an overdue recommendation for a book that really has stayed with me for many, many years since I first read it back in graduate school, like, what, 25 years ago. The Soul Stealers, The Chinese Sorcery Scare of 1768 by the late, great Philip Kuhn, who passed away very recently. His son, of course, is the NPR correspondent in Beijing, Anthony Kuhn, a former guest on our show and a good friend. It's a really exemplary popular history. I mean, it's, again, very accessible history, although it's written by, you know, a very eminent historian. Tremendously effective vehicle that kind of takes you from the humblest illiterate peasant up through the ranks of the bureaucracy to the imperial personage himself. It's just a tour de force in research, in structure, in narrative. So if you haven't read it, and I imagine that a good portion of our listenership has already read it, but if you haven't, rush out and pick that up. It's in tribute to the late Philip Kuhn, The Soul Stealers. Arthur, once again, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today, and best of luck on the book tour and with the sales. And again, pick it up, man, $10 on Kindle.
Buy the print version, please.
Buy the hardcover, which is like some absurd $87 or something on Amazon. But anyway, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Jeremy, you want to take us out?
The Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Gore and me, Jeremy Goldcorn. A big shout out this week to Michelle Wingley, who helped us as we prepped for today's chat. Special thanks this week to Anla Chung and to Amadeo Tumamilo from SubChina. Do drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/SenecaPodcast and follow us on Twitter @SenecaPodcast. Thanks for listening, and see y'all next week.